making a case for Randy Savage as the greatest wrestler ever.
This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Hey folks, I'm your host Stephen Graham, and welcome to the inaugural episode of Making a Case. There's been requests on the Twitter, on the Pro Wrestling Only, for a greatest wrestler ever focused podcast. And I decided to pull through, at least put this out as many as I can leading up until when the poll is due at WrestleMania this year. So there's a lot of people that want to be talked about, and a lot of people who want to talk about people, so we'll get as many of these as we can, you know, time permitting. But if you have any suggestions on guests you want to hear, or wrestlers or tag teams or whatever you want made cases for, or even like ways I can improve upon the show if I'm doing something horribly, please hit us up on Facebook. There's a PWOPTBN Podcast Network page, Pro Wrestling Only. There'll be a thread, and on Twitter, Stephen Graham TWS. You can make up requests there. I try to look at that at least every other day, even if I don't post. But that out of the way, this show is about guests coming on and making a case for someone, and I couldn't think of a better first guest than a fellow Canuck, a historian of Titans of Wrestling, the one and only Kelly Nelson. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Steve, and I'm flattered to be the first guest on this show. I didn't even know this was a new podcast venture before you started the intro, so I thought we were just doing one of your wrestling super shows, but hell yeah. Hey, usually Pete gets the inaugural episode of all these podcasts, so yeah, Pete, I beat you to this one. So
he's actually lined himself up for like number two. Yeah. So
okay, well, still I got one ahead of him, so yeah, awesome. Yeah, this is gonna be fun.
Well, you are the, you know, you've been a multiple time Brainbuster champion, and he has never won, so
right,
you take precedence.
That's right. I'm glad I earned something with all my victories.
You did. You become the number one guest request.
Okay, cool.
Awesome. So, this is a show where you make a case for why Randy Savage is, if not the greatest wrestler ever, or, you know, deserves to be highly praised. But before we get into your arguments and your case here, what is your history with the Macho Man? When did you start watching him, and how do you, did you grow up with him? What's your Macho Man history here?
Yeah, I got into wrestling in 1986, and, you know, look, as far as like Randy Savage goes, that was a pretty good year to get into wrestling, because he was red hot at that time. I was just thinking about it this morning. He was maybe like the hottest wrestler going at the time. I remember, when I got into wrestling, there was a friend of mine who came from a family of four or five brothers, and they were all big wrestling fans. And I can remember hanging out at their place, and his older brothers always talking about Macho Man and how great he was and all the moves he did and how he was better than this wrestler, that wrestler. And so there was a lot of talk right from the get-go about how great Savage was. He was the Intercontinental Champion that year. He, only a few months after I got into wrestling, was the big angle with Steamboat, where he heard Steamboat with the bell, that led to quite a long feud. And then, of course, was paid off with the legendary WrestleMania 3 match. So, you know, even though I was 8, 9 years old at the time, I was mostly into the good guys, the baby faces, but I had a lot of respect for Savage. I mean, I loved Steamboat, of course. And then a little bit later, or a year or so later, when Savage turned babyface and then eventually won the world title, or the WWF title, I really became a big fan at that point of Savage, to the point in 88, early 89, he was probably my favorite wrestler at that time.
He didn't become my favorite until 91. I don't know what that says.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I mean, you're a little younger than me, so maybe like a slightly
You cannot be a big Macho Man fan until you're 11. Maybe it's the rule. But
Well, I was about 10, 11 at that time. But he was, of course, then the focus of the show. And Hogan had kind of taken a secondary role for a bit there. And the first show I ever went to in Calgary, and it was January 1989. At the Saddle Dome, and the main event was Macho Man against Bad News Brown. Probably less than a month before the Mega Powers exploded. That's who he was going around the horn with at the time. And I got my dad to buy me a foam finger, a Macho Man one. And so that was my bit of memorabilia from that show.
I actually have a wrestling buddy of the Macho Man. The Macho King. But.
Oh, yeah. Later. The finger, I remember eventually the finger got ripped off somehow.
Oh.
Yeah. I guess I don't think I ever repaired it. It went in the garden.
What, would you sew it?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, what could you do? It was done. You couldn't get another one because there wasn't a store where you could just go and get them. You had to actually go to the live events at that time to get this, get the merchandise. So anyway, so then the Mega Powers explosion happened, and I was on Team Macho big time, right?
Yeah.
I even when I was younger, Hogan, I mean, I was, you know, I liked his matches were fun and all, but I always had other guys that I liked better than Hogan. I liked Tito Santana better. I liked Ricky Steamboat better. And then Macho Man I liked better. So I was definitely Team Macho. And when that went down, and then, so of course, Macho lost at WrestleMania 5 to Hogan, then eased his way into the Macho King role a few months later. And, you know, kind of after WrestleMania 5, I lost interest in wrestling for a good two and a half years. And I think a big part of it was Macho turning heel, who was kind of my hero, right?
Yeah.
And I would watch the occasional show, you know, in the next couple of years, like the WrestleManias. But other than that, I didn't really watch much. And then when I got back into it, it was when, like you said, it was when, Macho was feuding with Jake the Snake Roberts. And that was a big part of me getting back into wrestling. Another thing was Ric Flair, of course, coming to the WWF. That got me super interested. Cause here was the guy I could only read about in magazines coming to the WWF with the NWA title. And then Bret Hart, of course, was getting pushed as a singles guy, was another thing. And then the Jake Macho feud. So there was like those big three things, like a lot of exciting stuff was happening. I had a lot of friends in school that were into wrestling, so we were always talking about it. And yeah, so, and that feud with Jake was super intense. I'll talk probably a bit more about it later.
It might have caused my fear of snakes, because I'm not entirely sure where it came from, but,
yeah, that makes sense. I mean, because that was one of the more memorable angles of that time, was when Macho got bit by the cobra.
Oh, so disgusting.
I think, did they bust out the red X for that?
I think they did. They did at certain, yeah, they did, but they also showed it without it at some point too. So
Right.
Because I have a comp that covers that entire feud, and they had both versions on it. So
yeah. I guess it depended on what time it was being shown, maybe, or something. But yeah, we were talking about the red X lately on Titans, when it was used for Blackjack Mulligan's deadly claw. So it was cool they were still using it. I don't think they used it much more after that, but
I can't remember seeing it again.
They used it when Brutus Beefcake got cut up with Ron Bass's shears.
Yeah. It was one of my first wrestling memories. Like, yeah. That's like the first angle I remember is Brutus Beefcake getting cut up by Ron Bass.
But yeah.
I digress. As Macho Man got older, did you follow him into WCW at all? Or?
Yeah, well, in 92 he became champ again. Oh, yeah. It was pushed, and they had the big feud with Flair. So that was exciting, and I was still big into Macho. But then I started transitioning into more and more of a love for guys like Bret Hart, like first and foremost Bret Hart, Shawn Michaels, and the, you know, the sort of stereotypical work rate guys in the WWF from that time. And then Macho, of course, left. Well, no, first he basically was phased out to being just a commentator and occasionally wrestling. And then he left to WCW. I mean, WCW, as we all know, was kind of going through a bit of a poor patch at that time, to say the least, with Hogan taking over. And I had TBS. I got TBS just before, well, probably a good 4 or 5 months before Hogan came to WCW, when they had like a really good run there, right? With Flair and Steamboat, and then Hogan came in and kind of ruined it. And then I was kind of losing interest in wrestling again anyway. So I remember when Macho came in, I think I watched that Saturday night episode when he showed up, and it wasn't too impressive, right? It's like Macho coming from, you know, big time WWF, showing up on the puny stage of the Saturday night where they had those sliding doors with smoke coming out. It didn't seem like, you know,
just to say he would be at Starcade.
Yeah, exactly. It definitely seemed like Macho was slumming it. Anyway, yeah, so I didn't watch much of 95 WCW. And then it was hard to watch Nitro at first in Canada.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't on, well, it definitely wasn't on Mondays. It was on, the first time I remember being on was like a Saturday afternoon or a Sunday afternoon.
I remember it was airing on TSN after Raw, so it was like midnight or something.
Right.
That was later? Was late.
Okay. Yeah, well, in Calgary anyway, it was on like a local channel on like a Saturday afternoon. They would play it, which is like total, like a horrible time to have anything on.
Yeah.
And that's when I remember it was after the NWO was formed, because Sting was first doing the Crow thing. And then about, I can't remember how long it was until TSN finally got it. And then it was, I thought it was the day after. It was like on Tuesday instead of Monday.
Yeah, that does sound familiar. I know my parents had like an illegal American satellite in mid-97. So I think I saw some Nitro earlier, but so I can't remember. We switched to Canadian satellite at some point, and that's when I was watching on TSN.
Yeah. So I missed, you know, the beginning of Macho's feud with Diamond Dallas Page, which was kind of his last hurrah. I've gone back and I've watched the matches, and they're really good, actually. And like, I still had WCW Saturday Night, so they did show the highlights and stuff. So yeah, I got to see that. And then, you know, that was sort of, like I said, the last hurrah. 98, I think he blew out both of his knees, if I'm not mistaken. And he was never the same again. He took a long, about almost a year off, I think it was.
Yeah, about that.
Yeah, and then when he came back, he updated his look, and he had women, right? And that was cool, but he really couldn't wrestle much anymore. He was down to just doing, like, double axe handles.
Yeah. But somehow pulled a fucking great match out of Dennis Rodman.
Yeah, and I've never seen that. I've got to watch it now.
It's a wild, crazy brawl, basically. Yeah,
that's what I would imagine it would have to be like to make a good match out of Dennis Rodman. Yeah, I think I will watch that. If not tonight, tomorrow, I'll pop that in or turn that on the network. And yeah, so yeah, I mean, by the late 90s, other guys had eclipsed Macho in my heart, but I was still always a big fan and doing the voice, you know, everybody could do the voice. Oh, yeah. And he was always, you know, close, right, in my mind. Yeah. But yeah, his career kind of sputtered out at the end there. But I've always been a big Macho Man fan from day one, pretty much.
Awesome. So why do you feel you need to make a case for him? Like, where do you think people are ranking him, and kind of where do you feel he should be ranked?
Well, you know, I'll say he's now my all-time favorite wrestler. Like, in my, you know, last 6-7 years as a wrestling fan, especially after that DVD, the first WWE DVD came out, I really realized, you know, he's my favorite and he's the best. I think he hasn't been talked about a lot, it seems, on PWO anyway, with the greatest wrestler ever talk. He's been kind of under discussed, I would say. I don't know if that's because he's kind of such an icon that it's hard to, or it feels like a lot of people probably feel like a lot has already been said about him, you know, because he was so popular, and he's one of the wrestlers that transcended wrestling, and people outside of wrestling, people who aren't fans of wrestling, know who Randy the Macho Man Savage is, right? He's probably one of the five guys, I'd say, from the last 30 years that really have transcended wrestling.
His death definitely got a lot more coverage than you would expect from a wrestler.
Oh, for sure. I remember I was in Montreal when he died. We had just got there that day, and we'd been out all day, and I was just relaxing on the bed in the hotel room where we were staying, and I put on, pardon the interruption, the ESPN sports talk show, and that's where I learned that Macho had died. And so that shows you, you know, how big of a deal it was that he gets mentioned on a show like that. And it was treated as a huge deal on that show. So, yeah, and I understand, like, the point of the Greatest Wrestler Ever project is to kind of talk up the guys that haven't been talked up a lot, right? Or the guys that have been underrated, the guys that, you know, you have to make a case for, right? You have to point out the evidence of why they should be considered for the top 100. So I understand that. And so, you know, I feel like even then he hasn't been talked up enough. And I think, you know, for me, I mean, you know, for my list, he's going to be number one. I'm almost 100% sure of that. And I just feel,
what's the kind of main argument? Like, what's the biggest pro do you think Randy Savage has going for him?
Well, I think the biggest pro Randy Savage has going for him is he's like all around great. There was like every, you know, aspect of professional wrestling he was great at, in my view. He could work as well as anybody at the time. His promos were as good as anybody's. His charisma was as big, as great as anybody's. The feuds and the angles he was in are as memorable as anybody's from that era, like so many huge ones. And then his matches, like he has a backlog of matches that is as impressive as anybody's, I would say. I mean, yeah, this is, you may have to put him on a different scale comparing him, you know, the WWF matches, WWF style, and guys who worked, you know, in more areas, even though Macho did work in Memphis and did later work in WCW, but that's kind of a close, very close to the WWF. So, I mean, but I think his best matches are amazing. And also, he was a huge draw. He was able to carry the torch for the WWF in 88. And as far as I know, they were still doing really well with him headlining shows. And he was, you know, he was a guy that could pop a house, pop a rating for years. And, you know, like I mentioned before, he's iconic. He's for me, when I think of professional wrestling, like he's kind of almost like the symbol of professional wrestling. All rolled into one. I mean, he could do it all. So that's my main argument, is that he checks off, you know, all the boxes that you need to check off.
Okay.
To be considered successful and great, in my mind.
Okay. So I pulled a quote here. I pulled a couple quotes, but I'm going to read this one here by Childs on Pro Wrestling Only, a very famous poster. And he states, I want you to respond to this. Savage was my favorite wrestler as a kid. He just had a unique way of moving around the ring that pulled me in almost the first time I saw him. Great at projecting his character into his work. Made a fairly basic offensive package seem bigger than it was. Delivered huge and big matches. I don't see him as a top 10 candidate because his volume of great stuff was limited compared to the best of the best. But he'll fall in the 30 to 50 range. And there's a few other comments in the nomination thread for Randy Savage about kind of a lack of these great matches. And you did mention his great matches. So we'll talk about some of these great matches that he had.
Right. Well, I think first as far as the comment of not having enough great matches, it's like I've noticed this on PWO and in the Greatest Wrestler Ever debate is it's an uphill struggle to sort of challenge the Japanese all-timers, for one, who have definitely a large body of work. And it seems like their televised matches were more important, were more, their matches were bigger than, like a WWF match. Not to say the WWF matches weren't big, but there was a lot of, you know, jobber matches were televised, matches that really didn't have much importance, where it seems like most of the matches that were televised in Japan were these mega matches. And like, you don't, I don't know, I'm not a super expert on Japanese wrestling, but I don't think there's like the equivalent of like a Japanese jobber match or, you know, where it's just these 2-3 minute squash matches or whatever, right? Yeah. So it seems like the amount of matches that the Japanese guys have, amount of great matches, they have a volume of that I don't think someone who wrestled the majority of his career in the WWF can match as far as volume goes. But I think as far as quantity goes, quality goes, I think Savage's matches are just as great as any top 5 or 10 that you could pull from any of the Japanese guys, from Ric Flair, for example, Terry Funk, Jerry Lawler, any of the other names you want to throw in there. So yeah, I mean, there's several that I could list.
If you were to list like maybe like top 5 matches, top 3 type of matches for him, right, what do you think they would be?
Well, I think first and foremost, you have to have WrestleMania 7 against the Ultimate Warrior in at least the top 3. For me, it's number 1. It's maybe my all-time favorite match as well. It's up there. I think that is just, I mean, and it a lot of it has to do with the history of the Macho Man character, history of the Elizabeth character, who we haven't mentioned yet, Savage's longtime manager, and their whole history, as well as, of course, the angle and the storyline he had going with the Ultimate Warrior at the time. So knowing all that backstory adds so much more to that match. And then the story that they told being, of course, Savage comes in as a heel, and he had been since the Mega Powers exploded a couple of years earlier. But he comes out of it. But when it's all said and done, when Elizabeth comes back and they embrace and they get back together, he comes out of it as a huge baby face at the end. And in between, him and Warrior have a sensational, dramatic match. And of course, you know, Warrior, you know, to have a match like that with Warrior, and Warrior at the time was actually involved in, you know, his fair share of pretty great matches. But, you know, he's not someone you would consider, you know, up there with Ric Flair or Jumbo Tsuruta or whatever, right? So
Ultimate Warrior? No, yeah. I guess not.
So to have like an all-time great match with him as your partner just adds to it, as far as that goes. So yeah, that one with all the drama with the story, just is amazing as far as I'm concerned. But I mean, if you were going to get into Savage, or if I am making the case, and if you're not, you know, someone who has watched a lot of Savage before, you know, I wouldn't start with that one. That one, you know, I would save that for a bit and start with some other matches. For example, there's one when he first came into the WWF in 1985, in the summer of 85. It was actually his first match at Madison Square Garden. And so he'd never been there before. Some people in the crowd probably knew him. Of course, the hardcore fans would have known him. He had been on TV maybe a month before that, not very long. And he's against Vic McGraw, who had been in the WWF for a long time at that period. And within, you know, minutes of the match, the crowd is just heated. They hate Savage. He gets a drink thrown at him within the first few minutes. Like, it's amazing the heat that he gets just from, you know, his first appearance in a building the most hallowed arena in North America, basically, where the fans aren't easy to please. You know, it's New York. They're not going to cheer for anybody. You know, they New York's this type of city that loves the winner, loves the best. So, you know, that Savage was able to get over that quickly in New York is amazing. And he has this crazy match with McGraw. They were only supposed to go, I think, 5 minutes or so, and it ends up being about 15 minutes long because he wants to get all his shit in, that's for sure. And yeah, it's a fun match just to see, you know, someone who had never been there before, and just and within minutes he's like the most hated heel on the roster. It's really amazing. That's one. It's on the first WWE Macho Man DVD. So I recommend that. Let's see. Well, of course, there's the match with Steamboat at WrestleMania 3. That's pretty much, it's been talked about so much that it's hard to even analyze it, anymore. Mm-hmm. It was like, its influence in wrestling is huge. It's especially with, people who got into wrestling after that.
Bringing up that match, sorry to cut you off there.
Yeah.
But I wanted to bring up the fact, because some people have brought this up, is that Randy Savage is a guy that planned out his matches. He rehearsed them. He had them set up beforehand. And that's kind of how he approached matches throughout his career. Do you take that as a big negative, or you just kind of brush it off because maybe that's kind of what the modern style is, even if he was doing it earlier than everyone else? Or how do you react to that criticism that he could only do great matches when he had them planned out very well?
Well, that's a tough one. If we had evidence of like matches that he didn't plan out that were just horrible, I don't know. I mean, I don't know how. I don't think he was rehearsing, you know, every single match that he had, especially when they were doing, you know, 300 matches a year or whatever the number was, right?
Yeah.
I think, of course, the big ones, you know, on the biggest stage, he wanted to be perfect. And I don't know. I can't really fault him for that. I mean, he's an artist. He took a lot of pride in his craft, and he wanted to deliver the best possible product for the fans, best possible match for the fans. Yes, it's impressive when guys can just call it in the ring and come up with this amazing match, just based on, you know, their skill and their experience and being able to just, you know, do it like a Dick Murdoch, for example, someone that could just, you know, plug in a match anywhere at any time. But I don't know. I really like it paid off. It was worth it because the matches that he did have were great as a result. It's wrestling, right? It is a performance. It's mm-hmm. predetermined. it's like acting. It is acting in a way. It's like theater, and you have rehearsals, in theater and in acting. So, you know, I can understand wrestling was different back then in the territory days when you were traveling a lot from city to city, territory to territory, and you didn't have the time to do these rehearsals. You would drive from one town to the next, and, you know, this is who you're wrestling tonight. You know, you would learn that maybe a few minutes before the show started, and you didn't really, and a lot of times you didn't even know the guy. So you just, you know, went on your experience, and wrestling was a different form of entertainment back then. It wasn't as polished as it is today. It isn't the big spectacle it is now. It was a traveling roadshow attraction, carnival routes, and that was how it was. And Macho was, like, I think, you know, he was kind of a harbinger for the future of wrestling. Because as far as I know, his style, the planning it out in advance style, has become the dominant style, today. Mm-hmm. And you know? So, and I'm not sure if that was because a lot of, because of his influence directly, but, you know, that's where we've come to. It's something I can see that would, you know, a lot of people would fixate on that. And especially when you have guys like Terry Funk, like Lawler, like Flair, that just call it in the ring. If you're high on those guys, I could see, the predetermined style of Savage being a negative towards him. Personally, I don't. I can see, I can understand the criticism.
Okay. So, what other kind of feathers in the cap does the Savage, well, you know, and he has quite the cap to put those feathers in, and sometimes the feathers are on the outside, but, what kind of, what other, big pros does he have in his bucket there?
Well, we talked about matches, and maybe I'll bring up some more a bit later, but, the work, for the time, for, 1986, 87, WWF, when he arrives in 1985, to go back even further, he was such a breath of fresh air. He worked, a super fast paced style. He was coming from Memphis, and from before that, his father's promotion, the ICW, in Kentucky, that was, very similar to the Memphis style. So, and you can see this in his first few years there. He's totally working Memphis. He's outside the ring a lot, jawing with the fans, always doing something, constant motion. He's super athletic, and he was, a legit like baseball prospect when he was younger. And that was kind of his first love in the 70s. He wanted to try and make it to the major leagues. But super athletic, super fast-paced. And, he could go with anybody, with the best of the best at the time. Like Steamboat would have been, sort of the babyface counterpart of him as far as work rate went in the WWF. So, I think... his work was as good as anybody. Him and Bret Hart in 1987 have an awesome match on Saturday Night's Main Event. Mm-hmm. Before Bret, of course, was a singles wrestler. That's another one I would recommend people tracking down if they haven't seen it and watching that before they get to the more iconic matches.
Something a lot of people bring up when they're making cases for people is the wrestler's ability to carry someone else. And, a lot of Savage's great matches are with, like you said, Bret Hart, Ricky Steamboat, Ric Flair, some of the all-time greats. He does have the Warrior series, which is really, really good. But right. Is there any, the matches where he had with Duggan or Dusty Rhodes, those aren't highly praised. Is there any situations where Savage was clearly carrying lesser guys to better stuff?
Well, that's a good question. Well, you already mentioned, of course, the most obvious one with Warrior, who Warrior, and I've heard this, a lot of people mention this, that at his peak, he was, a very good listener. He basically, knew his place. He knew he wasn't the greatest worker in the world, and he would listen to guys well. So for someone like Savage, who plan things out and like to tell people what to do, it was easy to carry him. That's a good question. I'm trying to think, like, he worked so many major programs with the top guys that were good workers already. Dusty Rhodes in 1990, well, was definitely, at the tail end of his career. They had that mixed tag match at WrestleMania 6. I'm not saying that was a carry. Well, think about it, though. Think about who was in that match. Sensational Sherry was in it, too. But they had to carry Sapphire and a out of shape old Dusty Rhodes in that match. I can't say it was like an amazing match. It's been so long since I've seen it. I don't know. How about you, Steven? Do you have any off the top of your head that I'm...
The only one I can think of, there's Diamond Dallas Page, who, was coming into his own at that part, but
yeah,
that series, I think, probably was his first really, maybe the best series of his entire career.
Yeah.
So that, I think that might, you know, help the case of Savage.
Well, yeah. And Page was also a guy who planned his matches out in advance as well. It's interesting that the two of them hooked up eventually. The two sort of most well-known match planners of their era feuding with each other. But yeah, I mean, he made Page a star. Like, Page was getting there, for sure. He had momentum, and he'd improved a lot since he first started wrestling, that's for sure. But that was, that feud put him over the top. That, because Savage was one of the top guys at that time still. In 1997, he was definitely still one of the top stars in wrestling. And yeah, that made him, made Page a big star too. But yeah, I mean, I don't know. Savage is not someone, yes, that you would call a broomstick worker. That's for sure. But I mean, wrestling, one of the great things about professional wrestling is that there's so many different ways of working and so many different ways of having a great match and of being a great performer. And not everybody has to be a broomstick worker, right? Not everybody's the same. And then Savage, I mean, he did what worked for him and what, and it worked. I mean, the proof is in the pudding. I mean, the results are there. What he did, like, he produced and he became a huge star. No doubt.
I think one interesting aspect of Savage is a question of the amount of footage, because I think there's two aspects of it, and both kind of hurt him. And I'm wondering what your response to this. Because early in his career in ICW and in Memphis too, there's not a great amount of footage of him kind of in his prime. Mm-hmm. You can respond to that, but also you respond to that, and I'll bring up the second aspect of the footage.
Okay. Well, he started wrestling in about 73, I think it was, 73, 74. At first, just part-time, because he was still pursuing baseball, and he wrestled under a mask as the Spider. And he then would work pretty much wherever his father was working, Angelo Poffo, at the time, and with his brother Lanny. So he worked, Detroit. He worked, the IWA, which was that failed attempt at a national promotion. And he worked eventually in Georgia. And that's where I think he became Randy Savage. Yes, because, Ole Anderson, I believe, gave him the name, Savage. So he worked in Georgia. And so the '70s are basically dark, for Randy Savage. I don't know if there's really much footage at all of Savage from the 70s. And he apparently was having, you know, these epic matches with Bobby Eaton in, I believe it was the Mid-America promotion, the other Tennessee promotion, or the one that Nick Gulas, the original Tennessee promoter, promoted after Lawler and Jarrett broke away from him. And they had these Broadways, they had 90-minute matches, and they've acquired a big reputation as these mythic great matches, but there's no footage of them at all. What we do have of ICW, there's some really cool interviews by Macho, where already in like 1980, he's already like the fully formed Macho Man character with the voice and the hair and the glasses, the bandana, everything. But there is one match, that is out there in full, a main event match, against Ron Garvin from 1982, a cage match. And it's actually really, really good. Have you seen this
before? Yeah. Yeah. It's really great.
Yeah. It's worked in a totally different way than a lot of cage matches are worked. It's really violent. Just realistic violence with like belts being used. The referee's belt gets taken off and is used to choke. The finish is awesome. Savage lays him out with an awesome pile driver. And, that's another match. Definitely check it out, fans. I know it used to be on Daily Motion. It probably still is. So check that out. Randy Savage versus Ron Garvin, 1982 in the cage. So we have that, and you know, that's one match and a big match, but I mean, it's a great one. It's you could say this about so many guys where it's like, oh, you know, I wish we had more footage. I wish we had footage of them when they were younger. All we have to go by is the legends of, you know, in the old magazines and then, and fans who were alive back then and the histories and stuff. We don't have the footage and, you know, so Savage, though, isn't as handicapped by that as some people or some wrestlers, I don't think, because eventually he arrives in Memphis in 1983, at the end of 1983, in a really awesome segment where he arrives. Like, the whole thing was with Memphis and the ICW, Angelo Poffo's promotions, they had this legit war behind the scenes where they were basically, it was a turf war. They were fighting for the same areas to promote in. And there was incidents where Savage and his crew from ICW would show up at Memphis shows and wait in the parking lot and like challenge Memphis wrestlers to shoot fights and make sure like there were fans around to see this. And then, you know, one time Bill Dundee was pistol whipped by Randy Savage in the parking lot. And it was Savage. It was Bill Dundee's gun. Savage took it from him. Him with his own gun, and they would go on TV and they would break kayfabe. They would tell you the real names of these Memphis wrestlers, and they would issue like grandstand challenges to them and all this. So there was this real legit thing going on. But eventually, you know, in wrestling, you the goal is to make money. So ICW was failing, and you know it was time for an angle. And so Savage shows up on Memphis TV with his dad. And he's acting like, you know, and Memphis was great at doing these angles in the 80s where suddenly the studio would be invaded by these people and be like, whoa, what's going on? This isn't supposed to be happening. You know, 10, 15 years before WCW and tried it and all that and ECW. So you would get this feeling like, oh, Savage is here. Shit. And they played up how, you know, this was this crazy guy who was making these challenges and all this stuff. And he shows up and he destroys like these two jobbers in the ring with pile drivers and elbows. And it's awesome. So then he's in Memphis. And then, so there's a lot of footage of Savage in Memphis and he's wrestling Lawler. Of course, he's wrestling Nick Mockwinkle in, Memphis. He's in a tag with Lawler against, Rick Rude and King Kong Bundy. That's really fucking awesome. So he has a pretty good, list of great matches and memorable moments in Memphis in 84, 85. And then of course he goes to the WWF and then we have his career. And like I mentioned earlier where, you know, the Japanese guys have the big list of epic matches week after week. Macho had, you know, the majority of his matches in the WWF are totally forgettable, Saturday morning squashes. Mm-hmm. And there's tons of them.
Yeah, that's the other aspect of it. So you have a little amount of footage of his early career when he might have been in his prime and doing these things with Bobby Eaton and all this stuff.
Right.
As he gets to the WWF, there's so much footage of him, you know, wrestling 350 days a year in nothing matches. And then, you know, he gets later in his career in these kind of nothing WCW Saturday night matches.
Right.
There's all this footage of him not doing very much. And how much do you think that part of it hurts him?
Well, it hurts him in the eyes of the hardcore, uber, super hardcore wrestling fan that has seen, you know, all this Japanese footage, Mexican footage, multiple territories from the 80s that weren't the WWF where you had like, for example, Memphis Mid-South, AWA, that had a lot of major matches on TV and not just squash matches, Crockett. So yeah, like there's a definite volume out there, but it's tough. It's not like he wasn't in the right place. As far as producing like a huge quantity of great matches on tape anyway. It was just, that was how it was. I mean, you know, WWF, you had, a couple big shows a year later up to maybe four or five pay-per-views and you had Saturday Night's Main Event every once in a while. But that was, I mean, and then you had the house shows that were taped from MSG, Boston, Philly. But that dried up by the end of the 80s, pretty much. So there's, you know, pretty good matches there. For example, his first series with Hulk Hogan at Madison Square Garden is, I love those matches because the atmosphere is just off the charts. Like Savage was super over then. Hogan, of course, was super over. You're in New York. They get bloody. It leads to eventually a lumberjack match between the two. I love those matches. And they're, of course, more than just a Saturday afternoon squash. But it's apples and oranges, Stephen. It's, you know, it's hard. You know, if he was in these other areas, of course he would have been involved in amazing matches in those territories. You know, he did go to Japan a few times, I know. And there's one match against Tenryu out there. From a super show that they had in 1990 with All Japan, WWF and All Japan. That is really, really good. That's another one. It's a unique match because it's, of course, Macho Man in Japan against Tenryu.
He did work the Tokyo Dome a bunch of times too.
Yes, and that match was in the Tokyo Dome. Yeah. He basically brought his WWF, gimmick and his WWF style to Japan, like, and he had Sherry in his corner. This was during the Macho King years, and he has this match with Tenryu, and it's awesome because he doesn't change his style at all. It's Tenryu, All Japan Tenryu versus WWF Macho King, and it's fantastic.
I'll bring up one more statement from someone else about Randy Savage, and this is probably the most negative comment I've heard. So, and it kind of is about what we talked about. So I'll let you respond to this. This is from FXNJ. I've always thought he was overrated as hell. I don't understand why nobody holds it against him for mostly being shit post 1992, even while getting pushed as a main event guy for most of that time. What I've seen of his great, in quotation, 80s WWF matches doesn't hold up as well when you compare it to things outside the context of an otherwise mostly horrible product.
Ugh. See, I don't know. If you don't like Randy Savage, you don't like Sunny Days and Puppies and Ice Cream, you know, you're just a morose motherfucker.
But, you know, post-92...
Yeah.
He had some stuff mixed in, but yeah. What do you think about Savage, you know, after the retirement, post comeback there?
Right. Well, of course it wasn't, you know, all amazing or anything like that, but you could say that for every great wrestler pretty much. Like, what about Ric Flair's last how many years?
Yeah.
You throw it. Or how about even Misawa, I don't think, was pumping out like 5-star matches for the last bit of his career. Saruta's working comedy matches at the end of his career. Mm-hmm. Everybody eventually, you know, gets too old. Can't go anymore. You know, like, I don't like where, you know, to criticize a guy that they point to like his worst work. I don't understand that. It's like, well, yeah, he did that, but he did all this great stuff. Yeah, so he had some bad stuff. Nobody had a perfect career from start to finish where it was, you know, 5-star matches every time out. Yeah, it wasn't a great end to his career, for sure, as far as what had come before it. But I don't think it was any worse than so many other guys' last few years.
Yeah, I just wanted to get that. Yeah, that's by far the most harsh comment I've seen about the Macho Man there.
It is.
We've talked a lot about his pros. You said there were some more matches you wanted to recommend of his. Or is there any other? Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, there is. I mean, we've talked about quite a few of them now. The Flair match at WrestleMania 8 has always been, you know, one of my favorites. I saw that live on closed circuit back in the day. What a great match. And then 3 years later in WCW, they have a an awesome match at Great American Bash. That is totally different than their WrestleMania match. And has this, you know, violent edge to it with Angelo Poffo is at ringside, and he's quite old at this point. Yeah. And Flair attacks him. And so that match, that one's a real slept on one. I don't hear too many people outside of the PWO crowd talk about that one. And then in 1986, he had a feud with Tito Santana that produced several awesome matches. It went on for quite a few months after Savage won the Intercontinental title from Tito in Boston. They had matches in New York, Philly, Toronto, and then they have no DQ matches. And the no DQ match in MSG is really good, but the no DQ match they have in Toronto, I think, is even better. And then it morphs into Bruno gets involved as the guest referee, and then Adonis interferes, and so they have tag matches with Adonis and Savage against Bruno and Tito that culminates in a cage match at MSG, which is awesome. And that's kind of like the whole Tito feud right there is super, super great. Yeah, and I mentioned the other ones. Memphis, there's stuff to track down against Bockwinkle. Lawler, there's a cage match. There's the Loser Leaves Town.
One you have not brought up is the teaming with his brother against the Rock and Roll Express.
Ah, yes, of course. There's another iconic moment. That's the pile driver on the table spot on Ricky Morton that at the time, or at any time really, is pretty hardcore. I remember a friend of mine went to, I think it was Florida. This was back in like 1993, 94, for a vacation with his family. And he found the tape, a Macho Man tape, in a bargain bin there. And basically they were these tapes that, Memphis put out with like, Savage on the cover, Hulk Hogan on the cover, some other guys that were huge stars in other areas later on. But they had been in Memphis when they were younger, so there was this footage of them, and Memphis capitalized on it. And what my friend bought was this Memphis Macho Man tape, and it had the it had that match on it. I remember watching that for the first time and just us losing our shit over Macho giving Ricky Morton the pile driver on the table.
It's really an insane moment for like 1984 or whatever it was.
Yeah, just so casually done. Like, I don't even think it really even plays too big into the overall scheme of the match in a lot of ways. Busted out. Yeah. But, yeah, no, like, Memphis was like the perfect setting for someone like Savage. You know, with the constant chaotic environment going on there. And Savage is just chaos personified.
Yeah, that's a good point. He is pretty much organized chaos, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, we've talked a lot about the Macho Man here. Why don't you kind of go over your closing remarks, kind of sum up everything about the Macho Man you've talked about here.
Okay. Well, as I stated, you know, my main the main reason why I would consider him the greatest wrestler ever is he could do it all, and he could do it all great. He was great. He was a great worker. He was a great promo. His charisma, which we didn't really talk about. I mean, it's just, he's like a living, you know, and wrestling, wrestlers, especially WWF wrestlers in the 80s, were often compared to like superheroes or cartoon characters. Savage was like a cartoon character, you know. He just leapt off the screen. He was so colorful. He was so, you know, he had so much charisma. He was just larger than life in so many ways. He stood out from the crowd. And it was a unique charisma, like you never forgot. And with the voice, and then just the weird stuff that he would bring up in promos, like stream of consciousness sort of rants. So his charisma was just off the charts. The feuds that he was involved in, you know, Ricky Steamboat, Jake the Snake Roberts, the Hogan, the whole Mega Powers thing is really, it's one of the best things Vince McMahon ever booked. Beginning with, you know, the formation of the Mega Powers was basically Savage's face turn, in late 1987. And then you have this long drawn out thing where Savage becomes the world champion. Hogan, you know, goes away for a bit. He did make a no holds barred at the time. And then, you know, you have this slow build to where Savage is increasingly jealous with Hogan. He's increasingly, you know, paranoid that Hogan's making a play for Miss Elizabeth. And it builds and builds and builds. And then when it exploded, it was perfect. You know, they built it to a perfect crescendo. WrestleMania 5 ended up being, like, I think at the time, the most successful show they had ever done and would be until the Attitude Era. So that was huge business. I mean, that's just huge, huge, pro wrestling moment right there. We talked about the Jake feud. The Rumble, 1991 Rumble is another, high point of Macho Man as a performer, where he, costs the Ultimate Warrior the title against Sergeant Slaughter in a show long sort of angle, where first Sherry comes out and, you know, demands Warrior face, Savage, and then, yeah, the whole thing, and then Savage has to hightail it out of there, and he doesn't even show up for the Royal Rumble match later on. Just great, smashing the scepter over Warrior's head
and the giant light.
Yeah, the light thing. That is, and then running off, you know, at high full speed away from the scene of the crime. Yeah, like I love that show. That's one of my all time favorite WWF shows, actually. So yeah, he had the feuds, the angles. What else? The matches. Just, you know, great, great matches. He was kind of like, before Hart, before the rise of Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels, Savage was the work rate guy, I think you would say, in the WWF year in, year out. He really, you know, his matches at the WrestleManias were often, the show stealers, upstaged the main events, multiple times, right?
Oh, yeah.
And then, yeah, like, and the drawing power, which is something we haven't really discussed a lot, is, you know, he drew a lot. He was, you know, Hogan, of course, was on, another level than everybody else, but Savage was a solid number two guy and, could carry the promotion when Hogan wasn't the focal point. So,
and he was kind of, before even the NWO, him and Flair were drawing pretty big in WCW, really putting them back on track.
Yeah, yeah, that's what they say, is that turned around what had been like a total dead WCW house show circuit, you know, for years, that they started drawing with their feud. So, yeah, I mean, that's another feather in his cap. Because you have a lot of guys that are great workers. Who weren't great draws or didn't have great promo skills. So, you know, Savage had everything as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah. That's pretty good. Sums it up there. So, Kelly, I'd like to thank you here. We've gone about an hour, which was kind of the goal. So what do you have to plug?
Well, this week, actually, will be the 12th episode of Tag Teams Back Again with myself and Marty Sleaze. This episode this week will be the first of two parts on the Strike Force versus Islanders feud from 1987.
Exciting.
Yes, just earlier today we decided to make it a two-parter because we're going to use the first episode to basically talk about the Islanders' heel turn, the end of the Can-Am connection, and then you have Martel going solo against the Islanders for a few months before Tito comes on the scene and helps them, and they form Strikeforce. So the first part will be mostly laying the groundwork for the eventual feud, and then the second part will be looking in depth at various matches between Strikeforce and the Islanders. So we're both really excited about this, and yeah, I think it'll make for some good listening.
Yeah, for sure. What about Titans?
Well, Titans has been pretty spotty lately. We've been trying to coordinate schedules. It's become increasingly difficult. You know, it's four different time zones. We all work, different hours, different days. And so we're trying, the latest plan is to do at least, you know, two in December, to sort of get back on track. I think we've only had one show since the beginning of August. So it's been a long time. We still have a lot to talk about. We're into a, you know, another fun period for the WWF. Mid 1982, Jimmy Snuka and Bob Backlund are feuding. Buddy Rose has just shown up on the scene and is going to be a key part of the next few months. And of course, the biggest news is that Jay Strongbow has returned and is teaming with his brother, Jules Strongbow. And they are going to be around in the tag team ranks for quite a while.
So that is Parv, big news.
Yes. So Parv will now have to put up with not only Backlund, but also his favorite wrestler, Jay Strongbow, is back. So it's going to be a rough few months for Parv on Titans Wrestling. But yes, we're trying to get back on track and pump those out because I love doing Titans Wrestling. It's awesome. And, yeah, we'll be getting those out. Look for them in December.
Awesome. So, yeah, everyone check all those out and check out all the other great shows on the PWO, PTBN podcast network. And as Chris Ellner says, you know, check out his shows. They're probably the best. So, but I have some other shows too. So check those out. They're pretty good too, I think. But I thank you all for joining us on the first episode here. And we'll be back talking, you know, someone else, and someone else will make a case for someone else. So have a good night.